From 2009 to 2017, I served as an infantryman in the British Army's Duke of Lancaster's regiment. I applied to join just before my 22nd birthday, and to be honest, I really didn't know what I was getting myself into. But after the initial shock of training, I found it was exactly what I was looking for. I won't bore you with all the cliches about the camaraderie or the spiritual satisfaction that duty brings, because for me, it was the structure I enjoyed the most. I had a terrible time in school, so much so that my mom and dad thought that I had a problem with authority. They thought I was mental for even considering the army, and said I'd be thrown out within a week. But when the staff training you have all been to Iraq and Afghanistan 2 or 3 times apiece, and actually been in combat, it's a lot easier to pay them the respect they demand. And so, just a few months of training, I went from a dickhead layabout with a reputation for getting myself into trouble, to an infantry soldier, fit for service in one of the finest armed forces in the world. I joined a little bit too late to see Iraq, but I ended up going to Afghanistan for 6 months over 2013 to 2014 as part of an Afghan Army Mentoring Team, or OMLET. Soldiering was my life. I didn't want to do anything else, and I could see myself pushing 50 and retiring as some crusty old sergeant with a big fat pension and plenty of time for golf and the grandkids. But as the saying goes, God laughs at those who make plans. In my 8th year of service, so just after I turned 30 in 2017, there was an accident during a training exercise in Wales, and I suffered a pretty severe back injury. I did some rehab for a while, and I suspected that I'd be medically discharged, but the notice came, and I was devastated. I put so much faith in the rehab process that I hadn't mentally prepared myself for the worst to happen. So once I was out of the army, I just felt lost. I worked 4 different jobs in the year after I got out. I'd work somewhere for a few months, get sick to my back teeth of the job and the people, and then move on to something else, hoping the results might be different. I found the work dull. I had sawed all respect for most of my bosses, and most of my colleagues were a major pain in the arse, but no matter where I went, it'd be the same routine every single time. Get job, get bored, get shut. But then finally, I got a phone call from an old mate who was still in the regiment. He knew that I was having a rough time in the civilian job market, but he also said that he might just have the solution for me, and that solution came in the form of a very unique employment opportunity. The Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, is one of the most war-torn countries on Earth, and since 1950, it's been embroiled in 7 major civil conflicts. The near non-stop violence means that vast swaths of the country are now lawless, and are completely at the mercy of rebel militias or criminal gangs. These groups are often indistinguishable from one another, both in appearance and in their method of violence. But they both have something else in common, in that they both found a truly diabolical way of financing their operations. The poaching of rare and endangered African animals. In the early 2010s, the situation in one of the DRC's national parks got so bad that the country basically begged the international community for help. In Virunga National Park, poachers were killing rare birds, reptiles, antelopes, even hippos for their teeth. But the thing that really caused international outcry was when they started targeting the elephants and gorillas. Virunga is one of the few remaining habitats of the critically endangered mountain gorilla, so when conservationists noticed that they were being shot, caught, or killed in poachers' traps, they were devastated. African forest elephants are also critically endangered, so when the poachers started killing them, just to hack off their tusks and leg it, global wildlife charities reacted in a similarly furious fashion. And in the end, the European Union decided to set up what's called the Virunga Foundation, which took its entire African conservation budget and poured it into the defense of Virunga National Park. The foundation inflated the park's budget by around 80%, and then essentially took responsibility for both the park's conservation efforts and its overall security. They employed dozens of additional park rangers and supplied them with small arms, and then after only the most minimal of training, would send them out to deter poachers and evict illegal farmers from the boundaries of the park. However, while the rangers' initial efforts proved effective, It drove the poachers into an ad hoc alliance with a group of armed rebels known as the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, or for short, the FDLR. In late 2015, when a group of rangers and government soldiers attempted to evict one of the last illegal farmers in Virunga, they were ambushed by a team of poachers and FDLR fighters. When the smoke had cleared, 15 soldiers and one park ranger laid dead. In a bid to preserve human life and at the direction of both the Foundation and the Congolese government, the rangers ceded ground to the poachers and rebels. They hoped the move might put an end to the violence in Virunga, but they were wrong. In August of 2017, 5 park rangers were attacked while on a routine patrol near Lake Edward. They were first pinned down by a sniper firing from a distant tree line, and then as they struggled to escape, assault teams descended on them from 2 opposing directions. Ranger HQ sent a reaction force of rangers and Congolese soldiers to relieve them, but one by one, the rangers' radios fell silent, and by the time the reaction force reached their position, all 5 rangers were dead. And the same thing happened just a few months later during the spring of 2018 when 5 more rangers and a Congolese army driver were ambushed and killed. And this brought the total number of murdered rangers to a shocking 175. But, as in so many other similar situations, it didn't become critical until the region's tourism was affected. In May of 2018, 2 young British tourists named Bethan Davies and Robert Jesty were on a tour of Virunga when they were spotted by a group of rebels. The ranger charged with guiding them, a 25-year-old named Rachel Baraka, attempted to defend them, but was killed almost immediately as the rebels attacked their position. After a period of negotiation, along with rumors that an SAS hostage rescue team was en route to Virunga, Bethan and Robert were eventually released. But their kidnapping meant that in June of 2018, Virunga had to be closed until the safety of visitors could be ensured. And this, boys and girls, is how my job opportunity arose. And by the summer of 2018, almost every citizen of Eastern Congo knew exactly how dangerous it was to take a job as a ranger. Reports regarding ranger casualties were being widely and frequently published, and it was common knowledge that taking on the poachers and rebels meant doing so with minimal equipment and manpower. In so many words, becoming a Virunga Park Ranger was practically a death sentence. So as you can imagine, their recruitment levels dropped off dramatically. At least until they brought in the requirements and extended an invitation to international applicants. If you had any experience as an infantry soldier, the Virunga Foundation was offering very generous pay packets to anyone willing to help train and mentor the ranger teams. As I mentioned earlier, being on that Afghan omelet team meant that I had the exact expertise that they were looking for. It would be dangerous work, and there was every chance that I'd end up getting shot at. But for me, hearing that only sealed the deal. By some bizarre twist of fate, I had a golden opportunity to carry on soldiering, and you can bet your bottom dollar that I grabbed hold of that opportunity with both hands, like a chimp ripping its owner's face off. And just a few weeks after getting that phone call from my mate in the regiment, I was boarding a plane at Manchester Airport, bound for Eastern Congo. 18 hours later, I landed at Goma Airport at around 4 a.m. local time, then met up with my contact in the arrivals lounge. When I was first told about the former Green Beret, whose job it was to orientate international recruits, I pictured some Chuck Norris lookalike who ate bullets, pissed petrol, and crapped rolls of barbed wire. But when I walked into the arrivals lounge, the bloke holding the sign with my name on it looked more like a cross between Jim Morrison and Charles Manson. And I remember thinking, there's no way this guy is ex-Special Ops. But then, the more we talked, the more I realized that he was every bit as legit as he'd been made out to be. His name was Jason, but everyone called him Top because he retired as a first sergeant. He was also the top guy when it came to international recruits, so I suppose taking his title as a moniker just made things easier for people. He was in his 40s, had shoulder-length graying brown hair that was receding up top and then a bushy coppery beard that was a silvery gray around his chin. With his bead bracelets, lion claw necklace, and T-shade glasses, he resembled some kind of New Age safari tourist. But the lingo he used, the way he carried himself, and the fact that he was almost fluent in the local language all made me think, yeah, this bloke's the real deal. From Goma Airport, we traveled by minibus to a much smaller airstrip in the southern section of Virunga National Park. The journey took around 2 hours, giving Top and I plenty of time to get acquainted after he filled me in on what to expect. We'd be flying over Lake Edward before landing at a ranger base camp at a place called Ishango. There, I joined several other foreign volunteers in training and mentoring the rangers. But most importantly, I'd also be going on patrol with them, and going on patrol meant getting into scraps. Top made that abundantly clear to me. If I went on patrol, there wasn't merely a chance that I'd be exchanging fire with poachers or rebels. It was a certainty. And after arriving at the airstrip and taking to the skies in a small single-engine air taxi, I got a lesson in just how enormous Africa really is. For scale, the largest lake in England is Lake Windermere at 5.7 square miles, and comparatively, the largest lake in Scotland is Loch Lomond, which clocks in at a whopping 27 square miles. But then Lake Edward, which separates the northern and southern portions of Virunga National Park, has a jaw-dropping surface area of 897 square miles. At one point, while we were flying over it in what amounted to a rusty tin bucket with a propeller attached, it looked like we were out at sea, flying across the friggin' Atlantic or something. You could only barely see land off to our left, and the invisible shores off to our right were so far away that they weren't even in the Congo anymore. They were in Rwanda. Top and our pilot seemed to find a great deal of amusement at how anxious I was. I'm ex-Army, not ex-RAF, but flying over Lake Edward was smooth sailing compared to our landing at Ishango. It was still early morning when I arrived, but the camp was alive with activity. In one corner, nestled among some trees, were a grouping of small homes occupied by the 24 rangers which were permanently stationed there. The much newer volunteer accommodation was about 100 feet away, on the other side of the solar panels which supplied most of our electricity. There was a mess hall, sanitation pits, wash facilities, and an armory, along with medical facilities, a comm center, and even a football pitch the blokes used for recreation. I remember being impressed by what amounted to a pretty decent setup, one that was much better than any of the forward operating bases I'd seen in Afghanistan. But what I was really excited to do was meet some of the lads I'd be working with. The first, and probably the bloke that I spent the most time with, was an Irishman, I'll just call him Paddy. Now, Paddy wasn't his real name, but as an Irish Army reservist, he didn't have the proper permission to take part in a foreign conflict. And that meant, should the Irish Army have found out what he was doing, he could have potentially gotten himself into a fair bit of trouble. He was a great soldier, a good lad. Loved the crack, as they say, and he was a huge fan of English football, too, so that gave us plenty to talk about right away. Then there was the ginger lad from Texas with a backward name. Everyone called him Tanner, which I assumed was his last name, but then his full name turned out to be Tanner Scott. I asked him if some sort of mistake had been made on his birth certificate, because surely his name should have been Scott Tanner, but surprisingly, he couldn't see the joke. What he could do, on the other hand, was shoot the arse off a fly at 300 yards, which meant that I didn't give a toss my jokes didn't land, as long as shots like that did. Then there was Manu, the French bloke, who said that he'd fought in Malia before hearing about the plight of the Virunga Rangers. And then there was Nick, another American who was a massive animal lover and Tanner's polar opposite in almost every conceivable way. They had their fair share of disagreements, but there was a mutual respect between the two of them, so they worked well as a team. But perhaps the most intriguing of all the blokes on my training team was Yuri. Yuri was an absolute unit of a man, who looked a bit like the bloke Jason Momoa played in Game of Thrones. He claimed he was a mercenary, and sounded very, very Russian, but then when I asked whereabouts in Russia he was from, he almost blew a gasket. He said he wasn't Russian, that he hated Russians, and that he was from a place called Moldova, where hating Russians was a sort of national tradition. And after that, I thought that he'd got the hump with me, but it turns out that was basically Yuri's default mood, at least when dealing with humans anyway. And that's because Yuri, despite being built like a brick outhouse, was a vegetarian, and when it came to loving animals, Yuri made Nick look like Colonel Bloody Sanders. And unlike the rest of us, who were only too happy to take the Foundation's money in exchange for our services, Yuri had volunteered in the truest sense of the word, as in, he was working completely free of charge. Thanks to his exceptionally dodgy line of employment, he didn't need the Foundation's money. The only reason he was there was because he loved animals and he despised what the poachers and rebels were doing. Then when I asked him how he reconciled his love of nature with his penchant for killing poachers, he told me something I never forgot. "The poachers are like rats," he said. "They will kill the elephant and gorilla until none remain. Then what will they do? When they have nothing left to sell and nothing to eat, they will only slaughter each other. Better to send them to hell now, while their bellies are still full." We'd all fought in our fair share of mostly pointless bullcrap wars, most of which were based on lies and greed, of course. So to be somewhere we'd chosen, doing something good for once, it felt like it was good for our souls. But if it was good for our souls, it certainly wasn't easy on our minds or bodies. Patrolling the banks of the Simligi River could be tough going, but then hiking up into the foothills of the Hrenzori Mountains had us absolutely gassed. The wildlife was a huge problem, quite literally when it came to the likes of elephants and hippos, who can become very aggressive when they feel you're getting a little too close to them or their young. I was probably the most afraid of things like spiders and scorpions, but ironically, while their bites and stings could be incredibly painful, they weren't the things that you had to really keep your eyes peeled for. It was the snakes, like the Gaboon Viper, which posed the most significant threat to our well-being, mainly because they could be so well camouflaged among fallen leaves that by the time you do see them, it's far too late, and a routine patrol suddenly becomes a casualty evacuation, because you might just lose your leg, or arm, or whatever it's bitten, unless you get fast treatment. We were told that the bats, who roosted up in the trees in the forest, were riddled with things like rabies and even Ebola, and that if we got guano anywhere on our bare skin, especially around our mouths and faces, we were to report to the medics immediately because it was a potentially life-threatening level of exposure. We were also told to be on the lookout for bees and wasp nests because, if disturbed, their African variant had been known to pursue interlopers relentlessly before stinging them to death. And we had to worry about aggressive monkeys or baboons and the crowned eagles that nested up in the mountains could blind you in a dive bomb attack launched from nests that you wandered too close to. We also had to keep away from the freshwater snails who carried parasites that make death feel preferable to going to the toilet. But without a doubt, the thing that scared me the most were the tsetse flies. Tsetse flies are a little bit like horse flies in that they're the size of a house fly but will give you a pretty nasty bite. However, unlike horse flies, who as far as I know can't pass on any disease, tsetse flies can pass on a nasty little parasite which causes something called sleeping sickness. The early signs are things like headaches, high temperatures, and joint pain. And so at first it seems like little more than a stubborn cold. But then later, once the parasite invades the central nervous system, it can cause some horrifying symptoms. I'm talking about things like distinct and frightening personality changes, mobility issues, and a sudden desire to sleep during the day and stay awake during the night. Then, without treatment, the afflicted can grow weaker and weaker until they pass into a coma and die. Seeing as there are no vaccines for the disease, everyone at base camp, Congolese included, were absolutely terrified of tsetse fly bites and the sleeping sickness they caused. But thankfully, preventative measures meant no one came down with it, at least not while I was there anyway. Those were just the natural hazards that we had to worry about, but it was the unnatural ones that posed much more of an active and deadly threat. I remember the first time that we were out on patrol, the first of many sniper's bullets whistled past me. We were walking through fairly long grass at the time, so we were able to hit the deck and wait it out until it was safe to get moving again. Usually speaking, a small group of poachers would see a much larger ranger patrol and take a couple of pot shots at them, and then just scarper while we were all in cover. They were terrible shots, and probably didn't even zero their weapons properly because who needs accuracy when you're shooting an elephant? But that being said, it never failed to get the blood pumping whenever you heard that crack or whiz, depending on how close the shot came. Back when I was in the army, if we took shots from a sniper, we'd have our machine gunners ripping up the horizon, or we'd be calling in airstrikes in positions we even thought might be occupied by said sniper. But then, with the Virunga Rangers, we had to hold our fire as much as possible out of consideration for the wildlife. The poachers shot at whatever the hell they wanted, whereas we had to be absolutely certain about our targets and we couldn't open fire. That was very reminiscent of Afghanistan, so it was something I could adjust to. What I couldn't adjust to was almost being completely outgunned by the enemy. The Rangers' armaments consisted of mostly AK variants, be they Chinese or Eastern Bloc, and then a few shotguns and scoped hunting rifles for close quarters or long-distance engagements. The poachers' rebel allies, on the other hand, were able to field light machine guns, rocket-propelled grenades, and even light artillery in the form of 82mm mortars. I'd had mortars fired at me in Afghanistan, so again, I knew exactly what to expect. But as it turned out, getting shelled in the Congo was a hell of a lot different than getting shelled in Afghanistan. I remember the first time it happened, we were patrolling the gentler slopes near the base of the Rwenzori Mountains. And this was always risky, as the heavily armed rebel group made the mountains their HQ. But it was a case of either putting on a show of force, or show we weren't afraid of them, or they'd take it as permission to run riot in the park's northern sector, and lay waste to the many families of elephants who made it their home. So there were 14 of us walking up and down the slopes, me, Paddy, and Tanner, then 11 Virunga Rangers. We hadn't had any trouble patrolling the forest, but then we had to clear quite a large area of mostly open ground to make sure that the poachers hadn't left any traps behind. We'd been plodding through this field of long grass for a few minutes when I suddenly heard what I thought was a light aircraft passing overhead. My eyes darted upwards, but despite the clear blue sky, I couldn't see anything flying in the air above me. But that thought must have lasted no more than half a second, because as I heard the noise take on that telltale descending drone of incoming ordnance, I knew it was coming. I'd just never heard a mortar shell scream like that as it came hurtling down towards me, and the sound it made was nothing short of petrifying. Afghanistan is a dry place, so when something flies down from the sky at you, it makes a very distinct hissing or whistling sound. But in the Congo, it was so damp that the humidity affected the sound of incoming shells. That dry hissing before something exploded was bad enough in Afghanistan, but the shriek those mortar shells made in the Congo made it feel like the rebels were firing freaking banshees at us. They'd scream this 3-second-long sphincter-puckering wail that sounded to us like, "We're coming to get you." And that, let me assure you, was somehow far worse than getting next to no warning at all. And then, unlike Afghan, there were trees everywhere for the mortars to smash into, and when they did, the explosion would send a shower of splinters into whoever was unlucky enough to be standing under said trees. I saw some pretty horrific injuries in Afghanistan, but nothing like what I saw in the Congo. All the Rangers wore soft covers, either khaki bush hats or their signature forest green berets. So when mortars or RPGs exploded in the trees above them, they were incredibly vulnerable to the shrapnel and splinters that came tearing down through the canopy. I saw a bloke with a splinter the size of my arm sticking out of his face. It severed his spine so severely that he'd essentially been internally decapitated as it drove its way into his body, the only mercy being that it was quick and relatively a painless death. Another Ranger was not so lucky. A rebel RPG gunner scored a direct hit on the tree that he was taking cover behind. The warhead-shaped charge punched through the trunk like it was nothing and cut the Ranger in half at the waist. It only managed to drag half of him out of the fight, and he stayed alive and in pain for a shockingly long time. The rest we had to leave for the animals. Nick, the bleeding-heart American lad, took a bullet through the shin during a patrol along the river. It punched such a big hole through his leg that we thought that he was going to lose it, and as the massive, definitely not Russian Yuri tied the tourniquet around his leg and threw him over his shoulder in a fireman's carry, he was swearing and shouting, "My mom's going to be so mad at me." It's weird where your mind goes in moments like that. You take a bullet through the leg fighting poachers in Africa, but all you can think about is your old mom back home and what she's going to think about it. Not the months of surgery and rehab or the risk of infection. You think about your mom. But without a doubt, the scariest thing that happened when I was in the Congo happened towards the end of my six-month stay. We were manning some listening posts out in the forest overnight, maybe 10 to 15 miles away from the mountains. It was something the rangers had taken to doing in order to intercept the poachers who'd sneak down the mountains during the wee small hours of the morning before preying on animals at dawn. The tactic has proved very effective already, but they wanted to know if there was anything they could improve on in terms of positioning and procedure. So me, Patty, and Yuri ended up going out there with them one night. Nighttime in a war zone is always very frightening, and any little sound scares the shite out of you. Then, factor in that we were in Africa, with all kinds of massive creepy crawlies skittering around our wee fighting holes, and it made for some pretty scary moments. But none more frightening than the time we got ambushed whilst in pitch darkness. We were in our fighting holes, all spaced out over 3/4 of a mile, when one of the rangers started keying his radio handset. A soldier might do this if he suddenly spotted the enemy so close to him that he can't talk, or the enemy might hear him, so as you can imagine, we were expecting a scrap. But when it came, it wasn't the usual chaos we'd grown used to. It was surgical. One Congolese ranger got shot in the chest. Then when we all dived into cover, another ranger leaned out from the tree that he was hiding behind in the hopes of catching sight of a muzzle flash. But no sooner than he did, he took a bullet right between the eyes. That's when I realized whoever was shooting had some sort of night vision capability. They could see us, but we couldn't see them. It must have been like shooting fish in a barrel, to be honest. Rangers who exposed themselves to try and suppress the shooter were almost immediately cut down. Then as we all turned tail and fled, we were doubly exposed. As we ran, more and more of us fell, and for the first time, I was certain that the next bullet had my name on it. There were loud, blood-curdling cracks as bullets passed inches over our heads, and then ear-splitting screams or anguished grunts whenever one found its mark. It was easily the single scariest combat experience I had ever endured, and to this day, I'm not sure how I was able to walk away from it unscathed. Not when so many others didn't. There were about 20 rangers manning the listening post that night. 20 men who converged on one position with the goal of overwhelming what we assumed was a much smaller force. But it was us that ended up getting overwhelmed. Of the 20 men that went out into the forest that night, only 6 returned, and unfortunately, Yuri wasn't one of them. He wasn't the first foreign volunteer to make the ultimate sacrifice for Virunga and its animals, and I doubt that he'll be the last. But he was the only man to give his life when I was there, so I imagine I'll remember him till the day I die. There were a few more incidents like that, men being inexplicably shot under the cover of darkness, and then one day they just stopped. We went back to owning the night again. The poachers and rebels didn't seem quite so bold anymore, and although that obviously made us all very happy, it left us asking a lot of questions. How had the rebels suddenly got their hands on night vision equipment? Then why had they suddenly opted not to use it anymore? They weren't exactly short of cash for the most part, and nor were they professional soldiers, so it was possible they'd bought themselves some expensive thermal imaging equipment, only to break it through improper use or lack of maintenance. The theory swirled for a while, and then one day, Top, the coordinator for the foreign volunteers who met me at the airport, said he'd heard a chilling rumor on the SOF grapevine. Apparently, a group of Chinese mercenaries had signed a short-term contract to work somewhere in the Congo. The Chinese have been pretty heavily involved in sub-Saharan Africa for a while now, with their Road and Belt Initiative, so it wasn't out of the question that a Chinese-based private military contractor were operating in the region. But when one ex-SOF guy heard that they were headed to North Kivu, exactly where the Virunga National Park is, he figured that was information we needed to know. Unfortunately, we got the news way too late, but as any soldier might tell you, that's something you get used to in a conflict zone. The thing I couldn't get my head around was the fact that we might well have almost been ambushed and killed by Chinese special forces, either former or serving. We'd heard rumors that the poachers had backing from wealthy Chinese smuggling outfits who were heavily invested in the importation of rare animal parts. but for the longest time, we'd considered it just that, a rumor and nothing more. Yet what happened that night at the listening posts, as in the speed and precision with which we were ambushed, had made me a firm believer and makes me think that there's a much more shadowy game being played. After I got home, I read a book about the Scramble for Africa, which was the rush by European powers to colonize the continent in the late 19th century. My intention was to learn more about the place I'd almost died in, but all it did was make me consider the present. It seems to me like there's a new scramble for Africa, and the intentions of the countries involved this time are around just as ill as those who took part in the first. Hi, Let's Read. This story was shared with me by my late grandfather, who has long since passed away. He used to tell it to us as kids, sitting by the fire on cold, quiet nights. At the time, we thought it was just one of his wild tales meant to entertain us. After his passing, I found his journal among his things, and there it was, written down by his own hand. Now, reading it gave me chills all over again, as I always thought these were just fantasies in his head. But now I'm sharing it with you, exactly as told to me, because I think it deserves to be remembered. So thank you for sharing if you do. Long ago, back in the summer of 1925, I applied for a job as a game warden on a large country estate. I'd grown up in rural England, and as a boy I'd spent countless hours walking the local woods and fields and learning the habits of game birds, deer, and other wildlife. I had, and still have, a huge passion for the great British countryside, and so with that in hand, I approached the estate manager of the nearby Capsthorne Hall. I handed Mr. Wilkinshaw a letter of recommendation from the local rector, a man who'd known me since I was a boy. Back in those days, character counted just as much as ability, but the letter didn't appear to sway Mr. Wilkinshaw in the least bit. He told me that being a game warden was no job for a young man such as myself, and that even if I was bullheaded enough to disagree, Capsthorne Hall wasn't the place for me to start. I tried to plead my case, but Mr. Wilkinshaw was steadfast in his dismissal, at least until I'd turned my back on him and walked away a few steps. It was then that he called after me and told me if I was serious about working with him, I should return the next morning and after rethinking my proposal. Well, I thought about it, and decided that I still fancied life as a game warden, and so back I went the next morning to talk to Mr. Wilkinshaw. Impressed at my return, Mr. Wilkinshaw invited me to partake in an on-the-stop interview, which thankfully was far from formal. He took me on a walk across the grounds, quizzing me on my knowledge of wildlife and how I'd handle trespassers or poachers. I had to demonstrate that I could recognize the tracks of different game animals and predict their movements. Then, as for the areas of knowledge I was lacking in, Mr. Wilkinshaw assured me that he'd fill in the gaps. I'd receive ample instruction on the handling, maintenance, and use of firearms. I'd also be taught how to track a poacher's path, how to mend a broken pheasant pen, and how to set snares or traps with precision. However, once I had proven my competence, Mr. Wilkinshaw informed me that perhaps the most important factor wasn't my proficiency, it was how much I could be trusted. The landowners often entertained guests for hunts, and it was vital to ensure their enjoyment without any disruption or violation of their privacy. I assured them that I could do the job quietly and efficiently, and that the lord of the manor's private business was of no interest to me whatsoever. Then, and only then, was I offered the position, which came with accommodation in the form of a small cottage on the edge of the estate. My duties began immediately, checking the pheasant pens, repairing fences, setting traps for foxes, and patrolling the grounds after dark. It was solitary work, but I got a great deal of satisfaction from it, ensuring the game thrived and that the estate remained secure. It became a matter of personal pride for me. But at the same time, the job wasn't without its challenges. Poachers were a constant threat, and dealing with them required firmness and tact. But in those early days, I relished the responsibility and the rhythm of life and service to the land. But reality was, I labored in ignorance. ignorant of Mr. Walkinshaw's rather cryptic warning, as well as the estate's true nature. It was a clear, quiet night in the late autumn, the kind where the air is still balmy, but the faint rustle of leaves can carry for miles. I was doing my usual rounds, patrolling the far edges of the estate near the woods that bordered the nearby moors. The pheasants had been restless that week, and I suspected a fox had been prowling close to their pens. So, with my lantern casting a soft golden glow ahead of me, and my shotgun rested comfortably in the crook of my arm, I carefully and silently patrolled while keeping my ears and eyes peeled. As I approached the old oak tree near the gameskeeper's path, I heard an unnatural sound coming through the trees. It wasn't the stealthy padding of a fox or the quick dart of a hare, but rather a low, guttural growl that made the hairs on the back of my neck stand on end. It came from the deeper part of the woods, beyond where my lantern could reach, and the moment I heard it, I paused, my grip tightening on the shotgun. And then I saw it, just beyond the trees where the shadows grew thick. At first it looked like a man crouched low on the ground, but there was something about the way it moved, something that seemed wrong to me. Its shoulders were hunched and too broad, while its limbs seemed far too long to be those of a fox or even a deer. The moonlight caught its eyes, reflecting a yellow gleam that sent a shiver through me. It sniffed the air, and I could see the glint of sharp teeth and a mouth that seemed too large for any human face. My instinct told me to retreat, but my duty held me fast. Poachers I could deal with, predators too. But this was something else entirely. I raised my shotgun, calling out,
"Who's there?"
with my voice sounding steadier than I felt. The figure straightened, and that's when I saw its full height, taller than any man, with a body covered in coarse, dark fur. Its hands, or claws, whatever they were, hung at its side, long and sharp, and as my eyes found them, I began to question the strength of my shotgun. It stepped forward, slowly and deliberately, and I fell rooted to the spot. Was it a man in some terrible costume, an animal disfigured by disease? I asked 1,000 questions in just a few short seconds, but no answer satisfied my terror. Its growl deepened, reverberating in my chest like thunder. I raised the shotgun, then fired a warning shot into the air. The sound echoed through the woods, startling a flock of roosting birds into flight, but the creature didn't flinch. Instead, it let out a bone-chilling howl that started low but rose into a piercing wail. My heart pounded. I took a step back, and then another, and another. Thankfully, the creature advanced no further and instead stood its ground, watching me with eyes that glowed in the bright silvery moonlight. Then, as quickly as it had appeared, it turned, dropped back down to all fours, and then melted into the shadows of the trees. I stood there for what felt like hours, my breathing ragged and my shotgun trembling in my hands. Then when I finally found the courage to move, I walked briskly back to the estate, lantern swinging wildly at my side. The usual sounds of the woods unnervingly absent. The night felt heavier. I was not alone. The next morning I approached Mr. Walkinshaw and informed him of my nocturnal encounter. I had assumed his reaction would be incredulous, that he'd accuse me of drinking on the job or having far too fanciful an imagination. Yet he seemed so unsurprised by my report that I began to feel very unsettled. He told me that he too had experienced nocturnal encounters with such a beast, but that it was no threat to him or anyone else working at the estate. He said that, in a manner of speaking, the creature was Lord Capesthorne's pet, and that its ilk had called the estate home for centuries. Any encounter with one of the beasts was sure to put the fear of God into a man, yet he assured me that slaying it would bring untold woe to the estate and its holders. Trusting in his experience and expertise, I took Mr. Walkinshaw's word to heart. But every time I patrolled that part of the estate after dark, I carried a heavier lantern and extra shells and a prayer whispered under my breath. Whatever that thing was, beast, man, or nightmare, it reminded me that some corners of the wild still belong to the unknown. I recently came across a collection of old letters at an estate sale in Edinburgh, Scotland. They were tucked away in a weathered trunk, marked simply with the name C.E. Brady. At first glance, I thought that they might be just routine correspondence from a different era, but as I began to read, I realized these letters told a very haunting story, and I thought the Let's Read audience might appreciate this chilling tale captured in these letters. I've transcribed them here exactly as I found them, and leaving it up to you to decide if they're simply the remnants of history, or maybe something more sinister. As I said, what follows is a series of letters, exchanged between several authors during the spring and summer of 1891. They provide us with an insight into the life and times of one Charles E. Brady, a world-renowned big game hunter from Scotland, as well as those of his assistant, Jack Thompson. And they read as follows. Government House, Livingston, North Rhodesia, the 20th of April, 1891. Sir, in service of Her Majesty Queen Victoria, it is with great respect for your extraordinary reputation that I take up my pen to write to you. Your feats in the wild places of Africa are the stuff of fable, and your name is spoken with admiration in the halls of both London and the colonies. It is therefore to you that I must turn in a matter of utmost urgency and peril. Reports have reached me of grave disturbances in the Luangwa Valley. A beast of no ordinary description has wrought havoc upon the local settlements, destroying crops, maiming livestock, and, lamentably, causing injury and loss of life among the native population. Those who have survived its wrath describe it as a lion of monstrous size and ferocity, though some accounts veer in the realm of the fantastic, suggesting a creature beyond the natural order. Such an affliction upon the people not only jeopardizes their lives and livelihoods, but also imperils the fragile stability of the region. I need not tell a man of your experience that fear and discontent left unchecked can fester into larger troubles. Given your unparalleled expertise in tracking and dispatching the great predators of the African wilderness, I implore you to lend your skill to this urgent endeavor. Your task, should you accept, will not be without danger, but I trust that your courage is equal to the challenge. I shall see to it that you are provided with a capable retinue, adequate supplies, and whatever provisions you might require for the journey. I am fully prepared to compensate you handsomely for your efforts, but I hope that the opportunity to once more test your mettle against nature's fiercest adversaries, while rendering a noble service to the crown, might also weigh in your decision. I await your reply with great anticipation, and remain, sir, yours in earnest faith, Sir Arthur Ashbury, Governor of Northern Rhodesia. Camp on the Luang River, Northern Rhodesia, the 3rd of August, 1891. My dearest Margaret, I hope this letter finds you well, my love, and that our little ones behaving themselves as I would expect. By now you'll have received my last note sent from the ship, but I am writing to you now from deep in the heart of Africa, where the work I've been called to undertake has finally been laid bare. Margaret, it is no simple task that keeps me from your arms, but one of great peril, and if I succeed, one of great reward. I have come here to hunt a lion, but not just any lion. The beast is a terror, Margaret, a man-eater, prowling the Luangwa Valley and laying waste to everything in its path. It's already taken the lives of several poor souls and left the villages in fear. It's no ordinary creature, I can tell you that much. The natives speak of it in whispers, like it's a devil from the bush. And I won't lie to you, Margaret. It's dangerous work. This lion is clever and fierce, and the land here is nothing like I've ever seen before, wild and untamed. The nights are alive with the cries of beasts, and the air is thick with the scent of earth and fire. But Mr. Brady and I have been given a team of trackers who know the terrain, and I've got my rifle in good working order. If I'm careful and keep my wits about me, I'll see this through. The rewards, Margaret, are far more than I could ever hope for back home. The governor himself has promised a handsome sum for my service, enough to see us a good many winters and set the children on a fine path. This could be the opportunity we prayed for, Margaret, the one that lifts us from the scrape of life and into something better. I promise you this, I will return. 4 or 5 months at the most, and I'll be back to you in the weeds. Until then, I ask you to keep me in your prayers and know that every step I take, I carry your love with me. You're the strongest woman I know, Margaret, and it's your face that keeps me steady when the shadows grow long. Kiss the little ones for me and tell them their father will soon be home with the tales of Africa and a heart full of love for them all. Yours now and always, Jack. Camp on the Luangwa River, Northern Rhodesia, 5th of August, 1891. To His Excellency Sir Arthur Ashbury, Governor of Northern Rhodesia, Livingston. Your Excellency, I write to you with a heavy heart and grave tidings from the field. Upon receiving your summons and undertaking this expedition, I arrived with high hopes of quickly addressing the threat posed by the man-eating lion terrorizing the Luangwa Valley. However, what I found at the appointed village of the Luangwa River was a scene of utter desolation. The village was silent, its only occupants the dead. The beast you spoke of had struck before my arrival, leaving a trail of destruction and grief. Several bodies lay scattered, showing unmistakable signs of a lion's ferocious attack. Among them, I regret to inform you, was the man you appointed as my contact, a fine fellow, I am sure, who tragically fell victim to the creature's savagery. The surviving villagers, in their terror, have fled to seek safety further afield, leaving the settlement abandoned. This turn of events leaves me at a crossroads. With no fresh intelligence on the lion's whereabouts, I find myself compelled to return to my camp downriver and await further reports of its movements. It is my hope that the beast's next appearance will be met with swift action, but it troubles me deeply that its rampage may cause further suffering before I am able to bring it down. The lion's cunning is unlike any predator I've encountered in all my years of hunting. It is methodical, striking where it senses weakness and retreating before it can be caught. The terrain of this valley, though breathtaking in its beauty, provides ample cover for such a creature to stalk unseen. I will need every ounce of patience and skill to track it to its lair and end its reign of terror. I shall remain vigilant, Your Excellency, and send word as soon as new developments arise. It is my solemn vow that I will not leave this valley until the lion has been dealt with and the peace of its people restored. I only pray that the cost of lives and livelihood may be kept to a minimum during the time it takes to finish this grim task. I shall send updates as regularly as possible, though the isolation of this region makes communication difficult. Rest assured, I am dedicated to this endeavor and will see it through to the very end. Yours in service to the Crown, Charles E. Brady, Big Game Hunter and Explorer. Camp at Luangwa Fork, Northern Rhodesia, 14th August, 1891. My dearest Margaret, I pray this letter reaches you safely, though I fear its contents may cause you distress. I write with a heavy heart, for this expedition has taken a dire turn. What we thought was a single dreadful foe has proven to be far worse, and the task before us is now greater than I could have ever imagined. We've been tracking this lion southward along the river, following its bloody trail, when word reached us of fresh attacks in the northern villages. At first, we dismissed it as an error, a case of frightened minds spreading false alarms. But the reports persisted, and when we examined the patterns, a horrifying truth emerged. There is not one man-eater, but two. The realization chilled me to the very bones. These lions are no ordinary beasts, Margaret. They work in tandem, like a force of darkness bent on tormenting this land. As one strikes in the south, the other moves north, leaving destruction and death in their wake. The people here speak of them as demons in lion form sent to punish the living. I am no superstitious man, but looking into the devastation they have wrought, I can see how such fears take hold. We are left with no choice but to divide our strength. Mr. Brady will remain in the south while I make my way northward to defend the villages there. It is a grave risk, splitting our forces this way, but it's the only chance we have to shield the people from further loss. I trust that God will guide my hand and give me the strength to stand against this evil. The situation is desperate, Margaret. I won't lie to you. These lions are cunning and relentless, and the fear they sow weakens the resolve of even the strongest among us. But I cling to the belief that good men, Christian men, will prevail. We fight not for glory, but for the lives of the innocent, and I know in my heart that such a cause cannot be in vain. Please, my love, keep me in your prayers, and as I keep you and the children in mine. I hold your image close to my heart, and it gives me courage when the nights grow dark and the shadows press close. And I promise you, Margaret, I will return to you no matter the trials that lie ahead. Tell the little ones their father loves them dearly and that he fights for them, for their future, and for the good of all. I will write again as soon as I am able. Yours, with all my heart, Jack. Camp at Muwamba Crossing, Northern Rhodesia, 1st of September, 1891. To Mrs. Margaret Thompson, Yorkshire, England. Dear Madam, it is with profound sorrow and the heaviest of hearts that I write you today. I regret that my words must carry such grief to your home, but it is my solemn duty to inform you of the passing of your husband, Jack, who fell in the line of duty during our efforts to protect the villages of the Luangwa Valley from the scourge of the man-eating lions. Jack gave his life valiantly in the defense of others. His courage and selflessness saved not only the village he fought to protect, but also countless lives that would have otherwise been lost to the terror that has plagued this region. He stood his ground against overwhelming odds, and in doing so, he displayed a bravery that will not be forgotten by those who owe him their lives. Please allow me to assure you that his sacrifice was not in vain. Jack's actions turned the tide of our campaign, giving us the means and time to finally end the threat of these terrible creatures. I can also tell you with complete sincerity that Jack saved my life on more than one occasion during this expedition. Without his steady hand, sharp mind, and fearless heart, I would not be writing this letter today. He was a good man, Mrs. Thompson, the very best of men. Arrangements have been made for his body to be repatriated to England at the earliest opportunity. The governor has authorized a generous dispensation to cover all costs associated with his return and funeral, so that he may be laid to rest with the dignity and honor he so richly deserves. Additionally, further support has been arranged to assist you and your family in this most difficult time. Though words may never ease the pain of such loss, I hope you will take some solace in the knowledge that your husband's sacrifice was made in the service of others, in defense of the innocent, and for the greater good. His actions were those of a hero, and his memory will endure not only in your hearts, but also in the hearts of those he saved. Should you wish, I would be honored to share more about his deeds and bravery during these dark days. He spoke often of you and the children, and it was clear that his love for you gave him strength in the face of danger. Please accept my deepest condolences and know that you and your family are in my prayers. Your humble servant, Charles E. Barkley. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday and Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and there are super fun live streams on Sundays and Wednesday nights. If you got a story, be sure to submit them over email at letsreadsubmissions@gmail.com and maybe even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button to hear about the extra perks for members of the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations located anywhere you listen to podcasts. All links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember, in Jesus' name, boom shakalaka.